Everyone made it here for our third session as we think about the Sermon on the Mount and think about the teachings that our Lord left for us. And so, just to set the scene, in case you might not have been here in previous weeks, Jesus, in the early days of His ministry, comes preaching, "Repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand." So people might have had some questions about what this kingdom was. And so he begins this sermon with the Beatitudes and tells them who it is that is going to be in the kingdom of heaven. The poor in spirit, those who mourn, the meek, those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, the merciful, the pure in heart, the peacemakers, those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake. That's what the kingdom is going to look like. Regular people striving for holiness, living in humility before God. And so he talks about what the purpose is of God's kingdom. Just as Israel was to be a reflection of God's glory to the Gentiles, God's kingdom in this age was going to be a kingdom that represented Jehovah to the world. They were to be salt. They were to be light to the world. And so we talked last week about our role as disciples of Christ, as members of His kingdom, to be salt, to be light. And then Jesus talks about His purpose in this sermon, right? That He did not come to abolish the law or the prophets. And so that's sort of a warning that He's setting out because of some things that He's about to say in this sermon. And He makes clear that His role to the law is to fulfill the law. And He talked about those who try to relax God's commandments, who might loosen God's commandments. That's not what He's doing. In fact, He's going to be telling them exactly what righteousness is, what kingdom righteousness is, what God's expectation would be for His followers. And tells them, ending in verse 20, "I tell you, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven." So Jesus wanted to make clear that what you might have been taught by these scribes and Pharisees, what you might have been told is not sufficient to be righteous in God's eyes. And so He's going to go into this series of "you have heard" statements. And we're going to see this over the next several weeks. Jesus is going to say, "You have heard this, but I say to you that." So that sort of sets the scene of where we are as we enter verses 21 through 30, which is our goal for tonight. So let's just read to begin with, 21 through 26. Jesus says, "You have heard that it was said to those of old, 'You shall not murder,' and 'Whoever murders will be liable to judgment.' But I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother will be liable to judgment. Whoever insults his brother will be liable to the council. And whoever says, 'You fool,' will be liable to hell, to the hell of fire. If you are offering your gift at the altar and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there before the altar and go. First be reconciled to your brother and then come and offer your gift. Come to terms quickly with your accuser while you are going with him to court, lest your accuser hand you over to the judge and the judge to the guard and you be put in prison. Truly I say to you, you will never get out until you have paid the last penny." So Jesus begins the statement, "You have heard that it was said to those of old, 'You shall not murder.' But I say to you," was this teaching of Jesus about anger, was this something that they had never heard before? That anger is bad? Or was this something they should have heard as they read the old law, as they heard the old law read and taught? Yeah, so this isn't a brand new teaching. I don't think anyone should have said, "What do you mean, anger is bad? We've never heard that before. Never. That's not in the old law, right?" Because it is in the old law. If you read through the book of Proverbs, there are many teachings about anger being in the bosom of fools, right? There are many teachings in the Psalms, in Ecclesiastes. When Jacob is giving blessings and cursings to his children, right? He blesses and he curses Levi and Simeon, and he curses them for their anger. Someone turn to Proverbs chapter 16, verse 32. Proverbs 16, 32. Someone want to read that for us? Yes, the ESV renders it, whoever is slow to anger is better than the mighty, and he who rules the spirit than he who takes a city, right? And so the old law taught them that they should be slow to anger. Psalm 37, verse 8, taught them, refrain from anger and forsake wrath. Fret not yourself, it tends only to evil. So they had been warned about anger. And yet Jesus says, you have heard it was said of old, to those of old, you shall not murder. But I say to you, don't even be angry with your brother. So why did he need to say this to them? What was the purpose of him contrasting these two things? And why did he need to tell them this? Okay, so he's focusing on matters of the heart as opposed to what? Okay, versus action. All right. So perhaps as they think about the law and as they teach the law, and remember, most people in this day and age did not have an actual copy of the entire Old Testament in their home that they could go to and look through. So if people weren't talking about it, perhaps they might forget about it. And if people are talking about all the sinful actions, but no one's really talking about the heart, then it may be easy to forget that it's not just our actions that matter, it's sins of the heart that matter as well. Why else might they have been struggling with that? Why else might we struggle with the same sorts of comparisons? Here's another one, right? So there are things that are immoral, sinful, and there are things that are illegal. Because the old law was not just a moral law, it was also a civil law for the people and a criminal law for the people. And so there's an emphasis to say, well, I better not murder, because if I murder, I could get dragged before the courts and punished. And so we're not going to forget not to do illegal things, right? And so we have a tendency to think about, well, what's illegal? And as long as I'm illegal, not doing anything illegal, then I should be in a good position, right? And forgetting that, well, there are some things that are legal and yet are still immoral. And there are things that are immoral that are not illegal. And so if all we ever think about is, I better stay safe and not run afoul of the law in a way that's going to condemn me with physical consequences, right? Then I should be okay. Well, no. So part of what he's trying to say is that physical consequences, like being hauled before a court, are bad, but there are bad spiritual consequences as well when you have sins of the heart. I think I have those reversed, but anyway. So Jesus is trying to help them understand that it's not just fearing judgment that matters. And so he goes into this progression, right? And he talks in verse 22 about, but I say to you, everyone who is angry with his brother will be liable to judgment. Whoever insults his brother will be liable to the council. And whoever says, you fool, will be liable to the hell of fire. Why does he use three statements, restatements? Are they restatements? Are they different? Why does he use three examples there as he's teaching them about anger? Seems to show progression. Okay, so it's one thing at the beginning, one is angry in their heart without cause against another person, but perhaps they haven't verbalized it, perhaps they haven't done anything based upon that anger. The second is someone who insults someone. Some translations say raka, right? This sort of an insult of empty-headed person. And so you've taken your anger and now you've gone a step further to say that you're going to insult someone and call them an empty head. And then the third progression would be an actual moral judgment, you know, to condemn them as a fool. And so anger can lead to careless words and can lead to almost false accusations and unjust accusations. And so with each of those steps, as anger progresses in your heart, there are going to be consequences. But what is the ultimate consequence that matters there? It's not that you're going to be harmed in terms of legality, right? It's that you're facing eternal consequences for sin. And so part of what Jesus is trying to get them to understand is not just to fear legal punishments, but to fear condemnation in the eyes of the true judge, right? In the eyes of God. And so sins of the heart matter. And the way that sins of the heart progress in our lives matter. And don't make a judgment that only God can make in terms of calling someone a fool, right? Which the meaning of that word in biblical times was very different than how we often use it today. It really did have a moral sentiment to it, that charging someone with being a profane person, with being an evil person, and someone who rejects God's wisdom, which was a very strong accusation to make. Any other thoughts about how that teaching works and how that progression works in the first instance here as Jesus is teaching about anger? Okay. So then he follows that teaching with verse 23. So if you are offering your gift at the altar and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there before the altar and go. First be reconciled to your brother and then come and offer your gift. So why would it have been important to reconcile with a brother before bringing a gift to the altar? Yes, Miss Debbie. Yeah, so 1 Peter 3 teaches this direct link between how we treat people in this earth and our relationship to God. And that when we do not treat people properly here, it hinders our relationship to God. Where in the Old Testament would they have heard this sort of teaching about how the way you behave towards others and treat others impacts God's acceptance or rejection of your worship? In the Ten Commandments? How so? Yeah, so many of the Ten Commandments, you know, first they set up the relationship with God, but then they also set up our relationship with man, and that both are important. You know, Isaiah chapter 1, you know, that we read recently, you know, talks about this idea of vain worship, right? That when you go before God and offer worship, and yet your life does not reflect that you are living in obedience to Him, that your worship is vain. So Isaiah chapter 1, verse 10, "Hear the word of the Lord, you rulers of Sodom. Give ear to the teaching of our God, you people of Gomorrah. What to me is the multitude of your sacrifices, says the Lord? I've had enough of burnt offerings of rams and the fat of well-fed beasts. I do not delight in the blood of bulls or of lambs or of goats. When you come to appear before me, who has required of you this trampling of my courts?" And, you know, skipping down to verse 16 or verse 15. "When you spread out your hands, I will hide my eyes from you. Even though you make many prayers, I will not listen. Your hands are full of blood. Wash yourselves, make yourselves clean. Remove the evil of your deeds from before my eyes. Cease to do evil. Learn to do good." So, you know, don't come to God with this vain worship if in your life your hands are full of blood. If you are not treating your fellow man as if they are image bearers, as if they are God's creation, and if you're not respecting them as God's creation. Psalm 51, verse 16 and 17. You have someone want to read that for us? Psalm chapter 51, verses 16 and 17. So God does not want worship that is not accompanied with true humility and true worship in the sense of a broken heart and a contrite spirit. He doesn't want worship that is lip service, whereas our lives don't reflect that we are His children. Proverbs 21, verse 3, to do righteousness and justice is more acceptable to the Lord than sacrifice. And so they should have understood that relationship between worshiping God and how you treat your brother. And if you are someone who is living in a way that offends other people and you're sinning against other people and leaving those things unresolved, then your worship is going to be vain in God's eyes. Scott. Yeah, and John speaks of this repeatedly. You know, John chapter 13, verse 35, by this all people will know that you are my disciples if you have love for one another, right? And so the way God's people are going to be known is because they love each other. And then in 1 John, right, chapters 3 and verse and chapter 4, there's these repeated themes about being known, about, you know, 1 John 3:17, that if you have your... If anyone has the world's goods and sees his brothers in need and yet closes his heart against him, how does God's love abide in him? 1 John 4:20 through 21. If anyone says, I love God and hates his brother, he's a liar. For he who does not love his brother whom he has seen cannot love God whom he has not seen. And this commandment we have from him, whoever loves God must also love his brother. So yeah, as Scott was saying, you know, you can't separate the two. If you love God, then you are going to love your neighbor. And if you're coming before God and humbling yourself in worship to Him, but you won't humble yourself before a fellow man, right, who you've wronged, it's just hypocritical to suggest that I'm willing to lower the knee, bend the knee before God, but I will stand up before other men, right? And will never yield ground before someone else. Yes, Brother James. Yeah. So it's certainly still a relevant teaching, you know, for us today, that as we live in the world towards our brothers and sisters, towards our neighbor, towards our family, right, we cannot offer vain worship to God, lip service to Him, if we're not living as His people, and we can't expect that worship would be accepted by God. Brother Bill.
By their teachings or follow
Mm-hmm. And, you know, fits into what Jesus is going to say about knowing people by their fruits, right? And so if the fruit in your life is discord and disharmony, and you are offending people and you are sinning against them and constantly in strife, and yet you claim to be this servant of God and to worship Him, it's just incongruous. You're deceiving yourself if you think that you're serving God in that way. Brother James. Yeah, and so, you know, the next teaching that he gives, he says, come to terms quickly with your accuser while you are going with him to court, lest your accuser hand you over to the judge, and so on. So the idea there, come to terms quickly with your accuser, with the one that is charging you with sin, with the one that is charging you with the offense. Come to terms with that person quickly. What kind of person must I be if I'm going to come to terms quickly with someone who's accusing me of wrong? And on the converse, what kind of person is going to have a difficult time doing that, right? So I'll try and get these on the right side of the line this time. Come to terms quickly. What kind of person is going to be able to do that? Humble person. How so? Why is that important? Okay. Yeah. So I think that's two different things. One is that in humility, I don't automatically assume, well, I must be in the right, you know, and you're going to have to convince me, and it's going to take a lot of convincing that I've done something wrong, because I know myself and I know how great I am and how rarely it is I make mistakes, right? So you're going to have to really do a lot of work to convince me that I've done wrong. There's humility part of it. And then the second part you were talking about was, you know, that. That's right. So sometimes people have disagreements where it could go either way, right? But I'm insisting you must see it my way. There's only one way to see it, and that's my way. You know, and so part of that is humility. And, you know, I guess those are sort of two of the same thing. Part of this is also having a loving spirit, right? You know, 1 Corinthians 13 says that love is patient, right? Does not insist on its own way. Love bears all things. So someone who is loving, who is patient, who does not insist on their own way, who is willing to bear all things, is going to be able to come to terms quickly, right, with someone who has accused them of wrongdoing. 1 Peter 4:8 says that love covers a multitude of sins, right? And so being a loving person is going to result in people being able to come to terms much quicker. Yes, Ms. Debbie. Absolutely. So the peacemaker, the one who loves peace, the one who, and part of that is, you know, Philippians 2:3-4, right? That in lowliness of mind, you esteem others more important than yourself, right? Better than yourself. And that you do nothing out of selfish ambition or conceit. And so, part of being selfless and peace-loving, right, is the type of person who can come to terms quickly with those who have accused them. And there's also an element of wisdom in this, right? Because what is wisdom according to the book of Proverbs, essentially? Pardon? Fear of God, that's right. And fear of God meaning, if God tells me I'm wrong, I'm going to accept it, right? So it's being correctable. It's that you're willing to listen to correction. Whether it's God's correction, which is the ultimate wisdom, but also correction from other people. And if you have wisdom in the sense that you're willing to be corrected by others, then you're someone who is going to be able to come to terms quickly with your accuser, right? So wisdom, correctability. And then, just this idea of being poor in spirit, right? So, when someone corrects me, I am humbled by it, and I regret my sin, and I don't react in self-righteousness, right? I react with being poor in spirit, with being mournful, with accepting that I've done wrong. So if we're going to be the type of person who comes to terms quickly with our accuser, this has to be our character, right? Which really falls in line with a lot of what Jesus was saying in the Beatitudes. So what kind of person is going to find it difficult? I think we can probably just do, antonyms of each of these things, right? So if you're proud, if you are constantly thinking highly of yourself, then you're going to find it difficult. Loving, right? Well, what if you are not loving? What if you're hateful? Or, on a different scale, what's another sort of opposite of loving? Indifferent. Yes, ambivalent. Well, that's what they think. That's their problem. Doesn't matter to me. I know I've hurt their feelings, but that's their problem, right? They'll deal with that. That's them. So maybe I'm not a hateful person, I just don't care what other people think.
I think that's the, I see that kind of attitude being really addressed in verse 23. James touched on it a little bit, that when he said, if we know that we have offended somebody, but I think this verse is a real call to the possibility that you may offend someone, you may hurt feelings, and the person doesn't tell you, the person just tries to be stoic and deal with it. But I think it's a call for us to be mindful, just want to say today, about how we might be.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so that's a challenge, that we be mindful, that we care about whether I've offended someone or not, and that I don't just blow other people off, that I treasure the relationships that I have with my brothers and sisters out of love, and don't want to do anything that would harm it. And if I have, come to terms quickly, and be the one to take that step if it needs to be taken to repair it. The peace-loving person, the opposite, some of us just like drama, and thrive on it, right? And so someone like that is not going to come to terms quickly with their accuser. They're going to relish it, right? And they're going to hash it out, and they're going to talk to their friends about it and get people on their side and line them up, right? Because they enjoy the drama and the strife that comes with that, right? So some of us sometimes enjoy strife a little too much. Again, the selfish person who cares more about themselves than others is going to have a hard time coming to terms with others. The fool who is not correctable, who doesn't listen to correction, even when someone has shown me that I'm wrong, and yet I just won't see it. I can't see it because I can't see any way but my own way. That's foolishness, and that's going to keep me from resolving those sorts of differences. And, you know, opposite of poor in spirit, right? So the self-righteous, right? The person who just can't conceive that they're in the wrong because they are so convinced of what a good person they are. And so they're going to discount anything that doesn't square with that. But a bill. Some of us enjoy keeping score, perhaps more than we should. Absolutely, and that can be a hindrance to repairing damaged relationships. Yes. Yeah, I think that's right. We have a tendency to justify ourselves through self-deception. We deceive ourselves into thinking that we're not in the wrong, or we don't even think about the possibility that we could be in the wrong. And so we can rationalize things and make it seem as if it's not a problem. And sometimes we're not looking honestly at ourselves because we're comparing ourselves to others. We're comparing ourselves to ourselves. We're not comparing ourselves to the standard. We're not comparing ourselves to Jesus. And we're not looking in His righteousness to find, am I righteous in God's eyes? Because we don't really care, because we're righteous in our own eyes. And I've justified myself in my own eyes. And sometimes it takes a brother coming to you, like Nathan to David, and saying, you are the man, because you couldn't see it yourself. Sometimes it takes a spouse to help you. Sometimes it takes a friend to help you. Sometimes it takes a preacher to help you. But when someone comes to you and shows you that you are the man, that you are in the wrong, you've got to accept that. Brother Gene. That's right. The same passage says, do not let the sun go down on your wrath, right? So deal with it today. Deal with it quickly before these things continue to fester in your heart and address it today. Brother James. And that's really the progression that is made from verses 21 through 26, right? Don't be harsh. Don't be angry with your brother. If you have done it, then fix it. And fix it before it's too late. Because we all will stand before the judge. And so fix these things before it's eternally too late. So then Jesus goes on to talk about lust. You have heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lustful intent has already committed adultery with her in his heart. If your right eye causes you to sin, tear it out and throw it away. For it is better that you lose one of your members than that your whole body be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. For it is better that you lose one of your members than that your whole body go into hell. So again, was Jesus' teaching here about lust something they had never heard? Was this new? It wasn't a new teaching, right? Where had, in the old law, where had the Israelites been told and warned about the sinfulness of lust? Absolutely. From the very beginning, Exodus 20:17, right? You shall not covet your neighbor's wife. The Proverbs, right? The Proverbs, he's writing to his son about the adulteress. Proverbs 6:24-5. Do not desire her beauty in your heart, right? That's warning about the sinfulness of lust and the power of lust. So if this is something that was not new, why did Jesus need to say, you have heard this, but I say to you that? Okay, yeah, so it's not just, as long as I haven't committed adultery, then I'm okay. And Jesus is saying, no, if you want to protect yourself, you need to start with the heart, because these things begin in the heart. So that's part of it, right? So these things are conceived in the heart. But it's also that even if it never leaves the heart, even if it never progresses toward adultery, the sin itself in the heart is wrong. And so, you know, again, when we talked about the illegal versus the immoral, well, I haven't committed adultery. They can't sue me for divorce. I haven't done anything that's going to harm my family. Okay. But, you know, let's not just think about real world consequences in terms of, you know, things that might happen to me in this life. If we are concerned with our standing before God, we're concerned with our heart and His judgment of us. And even if no one knows, even if no one finds out, these sins of the heart impact your relationship before God. And so if we are to be servants of God, if we're going to be reflections of God's righteousness in the world, then we have to be concerned not just with our actions, but with our hearts. And His God is a God of purity, of holiness. And if we are to be people of purity and holiness, then we're not going to engage in these sins of the heart either. Yeah, that where your heart is, there your treasure will be also, right? And so that's going to be a theme, especially when he talks about materialism later. And so certainly if our energies and our desires and everything that we're focused upon are sensual, earthly, lustful things, then we're not giving God our best. We're not giving Him the service that He deserves. Brother James. Yeah, and so part of this is sort of advice to us, right? That if we are to be people of God, we have to be concerned about our hearts, because our hearts will eventually become our actions. Absolutely, right. So you can't you know, bring these things into your bosom, right? And have them fester there and not expect that it's going to be harmful to you. So then he goes on to this statement, if your right eye causes you to sin, tear it out and throw it away. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. So what is this teaching about and how does it relate to what was said before? Or maybe it doesn't. Maybe I only think it did, but... And it's important because it matters, right? So the temptation that I face is, oh, well, it was just a sin of the heart. No one even knew it happened. It's not a big deal. You know, my wife doesn't know about it. Other people don't know about it. It's not gonna wreck my marriage. So these things, I mean, they really don't really matter that much. And I think that's what this teaching is about. No. These things matter because not just earthly consequences that matter. And so bearing this sin before God and being unwilling to repent of it, right, and being guilty before God, that puts your soul in jeopardy. And that's worse than losing your eye. That's worse than losing your arm, right? And so to think, well, it was just a sin of the heart, it never really materialized into anything, so it's not a big deal. No, these things are a big deal. And if this is a problem for you, you should address it, right? And so it's that serious. I think that's the point of what he's saying here. If these things are a problem for you, it'd be better to pluck out your eye or cut off your arm if that's what it takes to address these things. Because that's better than losing your soul, right? Than losing your entire body in hell, right? So, these sins of the heart matter to God and should be taken seriously, is the teaching that Jesus is giving here. Brother Gene. Yeah, certainly he's using hyperbolic language, but the point is, these things are serious. It's that serious. Sin is that serious. And so if it takes drastic action to change your heart, if it takes drastic action to you know, become a pure person, to become a righteous person, then you have to be willing to take that drastic action. And you can't just keep saying, well, it's not a big deal, because no one knows about it, and it's just in my heart, and it's just between me and God. And even though it's a constant struggle, and I've been struggling with it for 40 years, and I've never made any progress, it's not a big deal. No, it's a big deal. Your soul is in jeopardy. And so that's how we should view all sins of the heart, whether it's lust, whether it's anger, whether it's any of the other sins that we're going to be talking about. We can't just minimize them and say, well, I never really acted on it. I never really hurt anyone. So it's not a big deal. Brother James. Yeah, absolutely. That's a great point. And so when we're thinking about, you know, these battles in our lives, we need to recognize that we are spirits inhabiting a fleshly body, and that carries with it certain temptations. But we must walk by the Spirit and recognize that we don't have to succumb to any temptations that are physical. And that if we will walk in the light, if we will walk in the Spirit, we can overcome any temptations that we face. No matter how strong our bodies and our passions and our emotions might make them seem. Thanks, everybody, for your comments tonight. Appreciate it.